Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. I am Carrie Weber, Executive Editor at America, and I am joined by Father Matt Malone, our Editor-in-Chief, and Ashley McKinless, one of our Associate Editors. And we have been talking, as always, about the news at the intersection of the Church and the world, and we'll be talking in a little bit with the writer Sonia Livingston and her article, which you can find at americamagazine.org, which is called How Cajun Country, an Old Ambulance, and 1,200 Frog Legs Led Me Back to the Confessional. It's focused more on the confessional part than the frog legs. So, you know, if that part is making you queasy, hang in there. And for now, we're going to talk a little bit about this article that you can also find at americamagazine.org called Religious Brothers Often Overlooked in Church Life. And if you said to yourself, what is a religious brother, then you'll know why they feel overlooked. The Conference of Major Superiors of Men in Phoenix met, and Marianist Father James Heft gave an address at their annual meeting, and he urged the church to look beyond ordained clergy for leadership. And it's, I found this really interesting because I think when we talk about that, very often we talk about it in the context of women and saying, look beyond priests. And it's because, frankly, people forget that there are men in religious life that are also not ordained and who also have a lot to say and are deserving of leadership in the church as well. Do you want to explain, Matt, for listeners who may actually be completely unfamiliar with this, or try to explain, giving a panic look, what a brother is in religious life?
Sure. Well, as you know, the church, the principal difference, as John O'Malley at Georgetown University would say, between Protestants and Catholics is in ecclesiology. So he said, historically speaking, when Protestants disagree with each other, they found new churches, new congregations. And when Catholics disagree with each other, we found new religious orders. Right? And what that does is it allows the church to respond to the promptings of the Spirit in a new moment, and to take a step forward, but to do it as one, to do it as a united community. And each of these religious orders has a particular charism, and, it's usually a response to some kind of crisis in the church. Not always, but historically, it's usually a response to some kind of crisis in the church. So when we lost our way around prayer, St. Dominic came along and gave us the Dominicans. And when we lost our way around poverty and became too enthralled with the riches of the world, along came St. Francis and the Franciscans. And, when we had the challenge of modernity and the Reformation, then along came St. Ignatius and the Jesuits. And so all of them have built into their orders a particular charism, a particular kind of spirituality. And the, religious life in these orders is characterized mainly by the same three vows: poverty, chastity, and obedience. And those are vows that are made by men and women who enter religious life, and they make those promises to God, right? And it's always important to distinguish between those vows and priesthood, and also what diocesan priests do. So not all people who are religious are priests, but all religious take vows, and diocesan priests don't actually take vows. They make promises to a bishop around their certain obligations of their office and also to remain celibate. So brothers, religious brothers, are members of these different religious orders who have taken those vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but are not priests.
Right. And so they're considered among the laity,
that
even though they're often mistaken for priests. And
And even though they might be wearing like a distinctive habit or kind of clothing, they are members of a religious order, but they are not. They're not priests. They are actually lay people.
Right. And women religious.
Or deacons. I mean, one becomes a cleric when one becomes a deacon.
Right. And women religious are also considered lay members of the church as well.
That's correct.
Which I think people forget, right? Because it's basically everybody but priests.
Yes. Well, what's interesting is that it's women religious who have traditionally been the women who have exercised the power of governance in the church when women were permitted to do it. And for example, the abbesses of the Middle Ages and of the early modernity, who were in charge of different abbeys in a geographic region, were more powerful than some bishops in terms of the power of jurisdiction and missioning and so forth, but they were technically still lay people.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting the history of how, as you talked about, religious orders and the role of lay people and ordained in the church has sort of evolved. The Father James Heft, who is giving this address, talks about that in the 3rd century, the desert fathers were typically not ordained. And even later, when the monastic communities began to form, they were largely lay. But then in the 12th and 13th centuries, the vast majority were ordained by then. And that in the Catholic Church, which I didn't really think of, that during the Reformation, the churches tended, on things that they disagreed with, the Catholics and the Protestants, tended to disagree and then go to the opposite of extreme, in a sense, as he described. So, you know, they disagreed over the role of the priesthood, and the Protestants emphasized this sort of priesthood of all the faithful, and in response, Catholics were like, priests are better than everyone. And then the Protestants put their emphasis on the study of the Word of God and preaching, and then Catholics emphasized the sacraments. And this happens, you know, in those tumultuous times, but there's vestiges of this that kind of stick with the church over time and how we think about what each role means within the church. And it can be hard when you get to times like our modern times, for people who try, for that's where you get some of the clericalism that you can see in the church as well, is that there's these sort of vestiges of like, well, the priests are called something much better than married people or lay people or single people or religious, when the church lately and since Vatican II has said all people are called to holy vocations that are meaningful and contributing to the building up of the kingdom of God.
Right. I think that's right. And, you know, it's a very powerful witness. You know, most of the Jesuits, for example, who are a part of, who are members of the Society of Jesus and have taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, most of them are not priests. I mean, most of them are priests, right? There's a small number of them who are brothers, who are Jesuits, who are not priests.
Our poetry editor, for one.
Our poetry editor, Brother Joe Hoover, is one of them. And, you know, Father General Kolvenbach, who was head of the Jesuits in the late 20th century, said that is actually the truest Jesuit vocation, is to the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and that our priesthood is a part, an extension of that vocation for many of us.
Interesting.
And that was, you know, and that's precisely because it is a different way of living life, right? So, you know, it's also commonly misunderstood that, you know, there's a canonical requirement, meaning canonical as in the canon law of the church, that says that priests in the Latin church, who are diocesan priests, are required to be celibate, right? But in religious life, you actually take a vow of chastity without regard to whether you become a priest, right? So in other words, rather than it being simply a legal prescription, right, it's an affirmative commitment on your part to live your life in a particular way outside of the state of marriage and within this community. So you might hear people talk about how with this law, which kind of imposes this on the clergy, that's a way of talking about it that might, in some circumstances, make sense to the diocesan priesthood, but in religious life, we conceptualize it very differently.
There's a freedom
choice.
In it.
There's an affirmative choice.
Yeah, it's right? Freeing.
Yeah. So that's all very interesting.
So if you want to read that piece, you can go to americamagazine.org. It's called Religious Brothers, Often Overlooked in Church Life. Overlook them no longer. Read about them on our website. Meet a few. Talk to them. Learn more.
Don't ask them why they didn't go all the way.
And become priests. Exactly. They're happy as brothers.
Right.
Don't bother them.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's kind of like saying to a junior accountant, why aren't you a CPA? Like within 6 seconds of meeting them. the church is a little eccentric after 2,000 years that's going to happen. And this eccentricity shines through in this wonderful story from Sonia Livingston, which we have in America, How Cajun Country, an Old Ambulance, and 1,200 Frog Legs Led Me Back to the Confessional.
Yes, Sonia Livingston, she's an author of literary nonfiction. She's written the memoir Ghost Bread, and she teaches creative writing at Virginia Commonwealth University. And she is kind enough to share her time with us today. Sonia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm really glad to be able to speak with you.
We're glad to have you, and we were glad to read your piece. It was a really powerful and compelling narrative about sort of two stories, in a sense. One of your physical journey down to Cajun country to meet a priest who runs what he calls the Spiritual Care Unit, which is a renovated old ambulance in which he hears confessions, and then one of your own spiritual journey back to the Sacrament of Confession. So maybe we can start a little bit with how you decided to take this physical journey down to search out this Spiritual Care Unit.
Sure. It really was two stories, and I think they're tied together. So I'll answer that question about the physical journey by, I guess I'm right now justifying the fact that I'm going to answer a little differently. But
Go for it.
I returned to my childhood church a year or so ago, and after lapsing for two decades, I'd attend church once in a while, I think, but I really really was drawn back a year or so ago and enjoyed the experience immensely of rediscovering the church, the mass, the rhythms, the traditions, except for confession. Whenever confession would come up, I would think, oh, right, confession. Like that was a thing I kept forgetting about, or I somehow blocked off. And so I think my way of dealing with that, whenever something seems a little unusual for me, is to try to read about what's going on with that sacrament. I began to become interested in the history of confession or reconciliation, and perhaps to justify why I was not participating fully, I wanted to read about others who weren't participating fully, or those who were, and what the differences were. So in my reading, I came across an article about this priest, Father Michael Champagne, down in St. Martinsville, Louisiana, and I was intrigued. I thought, as much as I sort of am trying to push confession from my mind, he's really made it a primary mission. And he's, traveled like 8,000 miles in fewer than 2 years and heard 4,000 confessions. So I was intrigued by what he was doing and why he was doing it. And I was selfishly motivated because I wanted to understand a little better about why I was resisting the sacrament.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think even people who are sort of consistently happy with being a part of the church are sometimes terrified by the prospect of going to confession. So I wonder if you were there and you saw some of the folks, the way that Father Champagne and his associates kind of reached out to people. Can you describe some of that to us?
Sure. Well, yeah. So it's, like you said, he has two units now. He has a converted ambulance and a U-Haul, which he calls a church hall. And he takes that around. He has, other priests and members of the community participate. But so the way it worked is that on the day that I was there, they drove to New Iberia, which is maybe 10 miles south of where they're located there in St. Martinsville. And they parked in a suburban strip mall outside of a Subway restaurant and they have it down. They know exactly what they're doing. So they set it up. They had a table with brochures and they had music playing, and people noticed them because they have this huge van with an image of Jesus on the side and French hymns playing So little by little, people came over and either went to confession or often would greet the sisters or give them a hug or ask for a prayer. But basically, they just set up shop in a public space, which is exactly what his mission is. And he rotates where he takes the spiritual care unit, usually outside of a shopping mall or a health club or sometimes a festival. He's gone to Mardi Gras and heard confessions. So
that would be a wild place.
I don't think we can go too much longer without explaining the 1,200 frog legs to our listeners.
Oh, yeah, the 1,200 frog legs. How does, you know, maybe you'll explain. Readers are sometimes better than writers, right? Like, the 1,200 frog legs grabbed me. There's one of the faithful in New Iberia, a supporter of their project, showed up, and I call her in the article Miss Evangeline. Which isn't her real name, but she was definitely an evangelizer and helped to get people to notice the spiritual care unit. They didn't need help noticing it, but she helped to invite them in. And again, I don't think that they really needed that, but she was very enthusiastic and a very, very much a Cajun woman, was staunchly Catholic and talked about hunting and fishing and the 1,200 frog legs she had in her freezer, which I used to talk, I think, a little bit about just maybe the way that culture can seem at times, especially to an outsider, sort of fierce or rough. There's lots of hunting. You know, there's bayous with cottonmouths, and there are alligators. And so the landscape can seem kind of rough. And I was really interested in how something so beautiful or tender could grow in that environment, such as his project and bringing the sacred into this public space.
That's true. I mean, that's pretty impressive. And it's right there at the beginning in the story of the incarnation, where the grace of God decided to enter into what you might think is a rather common earthly symbol. But anything anything can be charged with the grandeur of God by his choice or by our asking for the grace to see the goodness in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're
and I think with sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I'm not going to interrupt a priest, right?
No.
No, we're done with the.
You really should feel free to.
I was just going to say, I think it was the vulnerability is what I discovered. The people who were willing to, I mean, not only the wonderful community and what they're providing, but the people who were willing to or hungry to go into this unit parked outside of a subway shop and sandwich shop and open themselves in that way. It was very hopeful.
Right. Right. So you're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're talking with Sonia Livingston about her article, How Cajun Country, an Old Ambulance and 1,200 Frog Legs Led Me Back to the Confessional, which you can find at americamagazine.org.
So, Sonia, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about what it was like going on that spiritual journey back toward the confessional, because I know you write about throughout the piece how hesitant you were at various times, how you felt certain doubts, but you also felt drawn to it, and how you also discussed it with some of your friends. And I was interested to hear more about those discussions. As you were kind of hashing this out, what were the reactions of the people you were discussing it with? Because it's kind of an odd thing for folks who aren't familiar with it.
Right, right. Yeah, I think when I'm trying to figure something out, like many of us, I talk about it more than I should with people. So I talk to lots of people about confession. Lots of the people I grew up with who are no longer Catholics, we're wondering like what is the problem here? Like either go or don't, or be like a lot of people who don't go, who maybe still attend Mass but don't go. And then, you know, I talked with other people who didn't grow up Catholic, and I write about one such conversation with a friend of mine in New Orleans. So I flew into New Orleans before heading out to St. Martinsville and had a brunch with a friend and told him what I was doing.
Including deep-fried potato salad.
Deep-fried potato salad, which is sinfully delicious. So, so good. I had to put it in there. But he was raised Lutheran and didn't have a lot of experience really going to church much. But he was surprised that I was afraid of going to confession or had all these doubts about confession. He said, I always thought confession would be the best part of being Catholic. And I just laughed, and we talked about why he thought that was, because, you know, it's like therapy. You get to just talk and talk. And it's funny because I think that my generation, you know, like post-Vatican II, is very comfortable with therapy. We like going to counsel. I would go all the time if I could afford it, and you know, probably tell much more than I should. And so we don't tend to be ashamed about things, and that's wonderful. But I explained the difference to this friend between confession and therapy and the idea of contrition. And that's really where my stumbling block was, the idea of saying, this is what I've done wrong, and this is what's keeping me from goodness in myself or with others, or, you know, and so these conversations were really helpful. I talked to an older woman at church. Her name is Mary. She's 96 years old, and she's been sort of my mentor as I head back to the church. She's always got a great story, but she was all for it. She said, why wouldn't you go to confession? It's like getting a car wash for your soul. So everybody had a different take, and I listened to everybody. And eventually I do make my way, you know, back to church in the confessional, but it was really important to have those conversations along the way.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And what was it, what was that thing that sort of tipped you over the edge in the deciding of like, yes, this is what I want to do, and this is the time, and this is where I'm going to go? Because you write about, you know, watching people go to confession throughout the spiritual care unit, but could not quite bring yourself to do it there and ended up doing it close mm-hmm. to home at your parish, which also makes mm-hmm. sense. So tell us a little bit about mm-hmm. the decision-making process for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I moved toward, you know, the physical journey, I was also sort of getting closer to my own. I think I knew that at some point I would go to confession, simply because it wasn't leaving me. Like many things, I mean, I avoid many things in life, but they don't nag me like confession was nagging me. So I was hoping actually to go into the spiritual care unit. That's another sentence that you might not hear again, but I was hoping to go. And when I didn't, I had to look. I think that gave me an opportunity to look at a little more closely, like what exactly I was afraid of. I mean, fear is, you know, just one word, but it stands for so much. I was thinking so much about, like, what does it mean to sin, and who gets to decide what a sin is? And so I was focused very much on the content of my eventual confession versus the process itself, which is eventually what came to matter more to me, this idea of being vulnerable before another human being and saying, this is what I've done wrong and this is how I could do better. That I knew was powerful, and somehow standing down there in, you know, New Iberia, Louisiana, I knew I was headed in that direction, and only in going there did I eventually go back to my parish, or maybe I would have done it eventually, but it certainly helped me. It was an odd journey, but it somehow worked to let me see what was important and what I was resisting.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I really love about the church and its sacramental economy, its sacramental imagination, is that it has this profound understanding and respect for the ways in which human beings actually come to know things and the way that they come mm-hmm. to believe them to be true, which is mm-hmm. principally through our senses. And you know, we have to taste things and touch things and hear things and say things in order for them to become really real to us. And there's mm-hmm. something in the, when people will say to me, well, you know, why can't I just like pray in my room and ask for God's forgiveness while I'm looking at the wall? And I said, because walls don't talk back, right? Like you need to hear. It's mm-hmm. like when you say to somebody, I know you love me, but you never say it. Right? Like you, mm-hmm. you need to mm-hmm. hear the words in order for them mm-hmm. to really find their way in, deep into your heart and to have mm-hmm. to unleash their transformative power. And I think the same is true with you are forgiven or mm-hmm. I am a sinner. Those sentences are really, they're kind of things that need to be said out loud and heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a temptation, at least for me, to minimize. I definitely minimize that role, as you suggested. And especially, like I say, growing up where you know, this sacrament in particular was not highlighted. And so I've had to relearn that myself. And I think there's something about even before the priest says anything, just about going before another human being who is there fully, who is fully present, that is so powerful. I talk a little bit about how we are a confessional society, you know, that we post so much on Facebook, or, you know, we tweet and we do all kinds of sharing. But in some ways we are, you know, less connected than ever. And I think there's a real hunger for an interaction that is meaningful. So all of that came as a result of this journey south.
Right, right.
Yeah, so this all happens in the spiritual care unit. Was this inspired by Pope Francis's call to become a church that's a field hospital?
Yes. Yeah, I think Father Champagne took that literally, right? He wanted
right.
to get out there, and he's just dynamic. I mean, they have a lot. I was really impressed with all that was going on in the community. You know, I write about the fact that they have an 88-hour marathon reading of the Bible, and every August 15th on the Feast of the Assumption, they have a Eucharistic procession down the bayou, the local bayou. And so he's really making things public in a way that's really exciting to me as somebody who's, you know, from, I don't know, what are we in the Northeast? A little less likely to be out in the streets like that.
So. Right.
Well, you actually, through your reporting and contact with this group, alerted us to that Bayou procession. And Father Jeremy Zippel, our film editor, went down there and did a video of it. So if you want to see it, if listeners would like a look at the boat Eucharistic procession, which I highly recommend,
it's
up on our website right now. It's on our Facebook page as well, mm-hmm. America
it's
Magazine.
Called- A Cajun Eucharistic boat procession on the
oh.
bayou.
I don't
didn't know that. Did it rain? Do you know if it rained?
It looks a little muddy.
but I didn't see a single frog leg.
Yeah. He was covered with mud, as I recall.
Well, the word on the street is that the drone he was using to film it got caught in a tree. And
yeah.
then he devised a device to get it down ingeniously, which worked.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. He was just a little muddy in the aftermath.
Eagle Scout, be prepared.
Exactly.
I would imagine, I mean, I was like, this is my kind of Catholicism. I love this. Let's get in some boats.
You want to go down
like,
the Hudson?
The thing that I also really loved was this the thurible that they had in the lead boat, which is in the shape of a church, right? So the Blessed Sacrament's coming in one boat. Then they have this thurible in the other in the lead boat, and some altar observer. A thurifer is incensing the bayou as they're heading down
with the thurible in the shape of the church, being lit also by like a propane torch.
Right.
Yeah.
Love it.
It's amazing.
Yeah. You would not see that in the Northeast.
Right.
No.
Right.
It's
exciting, and you know, I was in Ireland this summer and was able to see a Corpus Christi procession. I mean, even those I haven't seen here. And so it is exciting for me to kind of go back to what was once considered normal or right mm-hmm. tradition and to rediscover it. I can't wait to see that video.
Yeah.
So you mentioned in your piece that you're not in the minority in being kind of uncomfortable with confession. 75% of Catholics go less than once a year or never. Going through this journey, what would you say to the Catholic that is feeling kind of reluctant about going back into the booth?
I would say, I mean, I sort of talked briefly just about focusing on the process versus the content, but I would say to reclaim it as part of our beautiful tradition, but to maybe to think a little bit about what that resistance is. That was really helpful for me because I went through different layers of resistance. It was first of all saying, well, I don't know that I want to feel guilty about anything, or I don't know that I think this is a sin. And sort of going through that really was important to me, even before getting to the point where, you know, I got together with my parish priest for confession. So I think that it is, you know, you said earlier, transformative. It is absolutely transformative on the individual level, but also on a social and cultural level, I think we are more divided than ever,
right,
despite all our connections. And this is a way to connect again, to plug back in a way that is much more meaningful than I think we can even guess until we do it.
Well, and that's an important reminder that just as sin is never completely private, every sin that we make against an individual or against God is always also a sin against the community. Mercy, God's mercy, is lived not just as a one-on-one relationship with the Lord, but also lived out in community, and that mm-hmm. and can be a balm both for the healing of our own hearts and our common humanity. So the piece is called How Cajun Country, An Old Ambulance and 1,200 Frog Legs Led Me Back to the Confessional by Sonia Livingston.
One more mention.
Sonia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care. God bless. You've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You can read this piece, How Cajun Country, An Old Ambulance and 1,200 Frog Legs Led Me Back to the Confessional.
He's just trolling
at americamagazine.org, and find all the content that we talked about in today's broadcast. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Kerry Weber and Ashley McKinless, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.